You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
David Sedaris has produced a string of very funny essay collections, all bestsellers. Me Talk Pretty One Day, When You're Engulfed in Flames, Naked, Barrel Fever, Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim, and Holidays on Ice. He's also a playwright and a regular contributor to The New Yorker and to public radio's This American Life. His latest book, Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk, A Modest Bestiary, is a collection of fable-like pieces that address some pretty serious issues like racism, border security, art criticism, hibernation, and interspecies dating. It's published by Little Brown. I'm very happy that it brings David Sedaris back to our show. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Oh, you too. Thank you.
I'm sorry. I was talking about the serious stuff, and then there we were with
hibernation is an extremely serious issue.
You begin the book with a poem. Would you read it for us? Do you have
sure.
a copy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would assume you knew it by heart by now. This is live radio.
Well, often, you know, when a book comes out, you have what's called flap copy,
mm-hmm.
right? And your editor writes the flap copy, and it says, this collection of essays or a short story peers unflinchingly into the heart of the... And I just feel so sorry for anybody having to write that. So I said to my editor, I'll write it. So this is what I wrote. If animals were more like us, if mice kept pets and toads could cuss, if dogs had wives and chipmunks dated, sheep sat still and meditated, then in the forest, field, and dairy, you might find this bestiary, read by storks, by rats and kitties, skimmed by cows with milk-stained titties. I found the book to be most droll, might quip the bear, the owl, the mole. Others, though, would be more coarse. Bull, could say the pig and horse. As to the scribe, they'd quote the hen. Trust me, he's no La Fontaine.
Very nice. Have you been writing poetry over the years?
I love rhyming dictionaries. Do you ever use one? They're fantastic. Every possible rhyme is in the rhyming dictionary, and then you can say, oh, I want a three-syllable rhyme or a four or a seven. It does all the work for you.
And La Fontaine is in the rhyming dictionary?
I didn't use the dictionary for that particular line, but I'm sure he is in there. If you looked under hen and looked for things that would rhyme, I just kind of came up with that on my own. But a lot of songwriters use it. I always thought they would consider it cheating, but they don't.
And to some degree, you're setting the tone for a different kind of David Sedaris book by writing that poem.
I think so, yes. But it is a complete departure. I feel good about that.
Well, it's not Mother Goosean, but it is that poem does suggest that we're thinking in Aesopian terms, aren't we?
Well, I hesitated to read any Aesop or La Fontaine because I was worried that I would just start rewriting those stories. So I avoided them. But what started me writing them is someone gave me an audiobook. I love audiobooks. They gave me an audiobook, and it was South African folk tales. And it should have been called, like, the lame collection of South African folk tales. They were just really bad. And I thought, oh, I can do better than that. So that's sort of what started me writing these.
And you have characters that include a self-pitying bear, a murderous cow, a vigilant rabbit, a hairdressing baboon. Part of the challenge here was matching human personalities to animals. Or was that obvious to you?
Well, at first, I thought of this as a collection of fables, but fables always have morals, and these all don't, you know. And then I thought of it as do you say bestiary or bestiary?
Well, I said bestiary.
In England, they say bestiary. I think here we...
Well, I did go to school in England for a while.
That must be it. But I guess a bestiary is just a book where people do things. Animals do things that people do.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose then I just started thinking of it in those terms, because sometimes the animals, I mean, there is no moral. But like I wrote a story about an Irish setter, the marriage of an Irish setter and his half-breed wife. But actually, those wouldn't be people, because people can come and go as they like, but dogs can only be let outdoors at the discretion of their masters. So if they were people, they'd have to be slaves or concubines or something. So then when I look back on it, some of these, I don't know that they actually could be people.
But this does come out of something that many people think of when they look at their dogs or their cats. What is he thinking? Oh, he seems so human. We have that whole tradition, not just of La Fontaine and Aesop, but we also have Walt Disney and all of those cartoons where we have animals who then take on human characteristics. Crazy Cat. You're part of an incredible tradition here, David.
I like it. It's so funny to me that your example was Crazy Cat.
Well, Crazy Cat's my favorite of the whole batch.
I always one of the rules that I made for myself when I started writing these is I didn't want any of the animals to have names, because when they do have names, even that invites judgment upon them. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, no one will have a name, so that and another thing I liked about it was you can just cut to the chase with a story like this. You can say the squirrel and the chipmunk had been dating for 2 weeks when they ran out of things to talk about. And I don't have to describe the squirrel because you've seen one. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows what these animals look like, so you can just kind of cut to the chase. And I always knew that it was going to be illustrated. So for anyone who didn't know, like maybe someone in India doesn't know what a chipmunk looks like, but they can just look at the picture and figure it out that way.
And the illustrations are done by Ian Faulkner, who's best known for his Olivia the Pig children's book series. Was he your first choice?
He was my first choice. He did the sets for a production of Santaland that they mounted off Broadway here, like, I don't know, 15 years ago. And Ian did the sets. And so we met then. And then we did a little project together for Art Spiegelman. And we just always wanted to work with him again. So he was the first person that I thought of. I absolutely love the drawings that he came up with. It was so, and I didn't tell him what to do. I didn't, because I think he knows better than me. But I loved, you know, when the drawings would come in and then they would show them to me, because I don't, my imagination doesn't work that way. And I wouldn't know which picture to make for each of these stories. And he absolutely did. I couldn't be more pleased.
But this kind of collaboration is something that I'm sure you're used to when you wrote plays, because you write a line and then an actor takes that line and makes something different out of it. The same thing happens here. You wind up going into another level when an illustrator really understands and runs with it.
But I hadn't ever had an illustrated book before, so that was just, I mean, things are illustrated for the New Yorker, mm-hmm. but, oh, I don't know, I've just never had them in a book before. And in terms of writing a play, I almost feel like that was never mine. Like, if I write a play and then we get together to read it out loud, I never read those lines myself, so I had
no... You don't
say
them out loud while you're writing them?
Oh, I might mumble something, but I never really kind of claimed ownership. But a lot of these stories, you know, I read them on tour and I'd read them over and over and over again. But for the book on tape, I wanted, I can't ever listen to my own books on tape because they're read by me. Mm-hmm. And I don't care for my voice. So for this one, I wanted help. And so I got Dylan Baker read four of the stories. Sean Phillips read four of the stories. And Elaine Stritch read four of the stories. So there were stories like The Motherless Bear that I had read over and over, and then to hear Elaine Stritch read it, like whoever said my way was right. There's a line where the motherless bear, her friend is saying, oh, you know, you just need to get your mind off of that, and why don't you dig yourself a new den? And when I would read the story, the bear would say, but I like my den the way it is. And Elaine Stritch says, but I like my den the way it is.
Read it your way anymore, or do you have to read it with Elaine Stritch's voice?
I think I'd have to read it her way, because her way was the right way, and Sean Phillips' way was the right way, and Dylan Baker's way was the right way.
Or maybe not the right way, but they give it another dimension.
I prefer their dimensions.
Now, you didn't name these animals, but doesn't your brother Paul have an animal nickname for himself?
Yes, he calls himself the rooster. There is a rooster in this book, and he does sound kind of, he just has a few lines, but he sounds just like my brother.
Did you grow up with pets?
Oh, yeah, we had pets, but I was never, like, I like animals, but I like reading, like, about parasites, or I enjoy.
You like reading about parasites?
Yeah, or crows, or centipedes, or I like reading about how horrible animals can be, but I don't have any pets.
Mm-hmm.
I every now and then I'll find something and bring it home.
Do you have certain animals that you particularly dislike when you were working on assigning human emotions to certain animals? Were there some out there that you just...
It's not going to win me any friends, but I don't like dogs. Don't trust them. Don't like them.
Were you bitten when you were a kid?
No, never was. Went to Iceland recently. And until a few years ago, it was against the law to own a dog in Reykjavik. And so cats are just used to having their way. And you walk down the street and there are cats everywhere. The same way that you would see deer in a place where they have no natural predators. You know, they're just bold and confident. And that was the place for me, I'll tell you.
Well, you've lived in Paris and London. Now Reykjavik?
No, I just was there for a book festival. And I noticed, like, what's so great about this place? Why do I feel so good? And then I noticed that I didn't see any dogs.
Where are you living these days?
Now I mainly live in England. And
You don't have to take language classes.
No, that's what's sort of kind of great about it.
Although, you know, I see an awful lot of English films as part of the job here. And I often wish that they would put subtitles on them.
There have been times, especially in Scotland, when I've just had to absolutely guess what people are saying to me. But I can't sustain any kind of an accent, so I don't write about it very often, because if I were on stage reading about it, often what I hear is funny because of the way that it's said. And if I can't mock that, then I just assume not write about it.
Well, they have the advantage over us. They understand American English a lot better than we understand certain British dialects.
Mm-hmm. But I'm even still hearing things that I'd never... I always liked that in France, too. Like, I know this French woman, and she went to a wedding, and it was a very wealthy family, and then the daughter married a fellow who worked at her health club. And so I said, how was the wedding? And this French woman said, it was like throwing jam to the pigs, which I guess is a common expression.
But it works very well.
Mm-hmm.
David Sedaris' latest book, with illustrations by Ian Faulkner, is Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk. It's published by Little Brown. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with David Sedaris, whose latest book is a departure for him. It's called Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk, and it is subtitled a Modern Bestiary.
Modest.
A Modest. Oop, I misread.
No, but that's not your fault, because it got
misprinted.
Because
it's a Middle Ages. Bestiaries were very common in the Middle Ages, so I made that leap automatically.
But no, someone made a mistake, and they wrote that the subtitle was Modern Bestiary, and then I think that got written down a few places. The English were afraid that children were going to pick the book up. So in England, the subtitle is A Wicked Bestiary. Uh-huh. But I didn't think it was wicked enough to deserve the word wicked, but they use it differently there.
Well, some of these stories tend to be rather dark, not for children.
I was interviewed by somebody a few weeks ago, and he said, oh, I see this book. It's bedtime stories for children who drink.
And you obviously like that. Although the animals in this book are doing human things, dealing with marital issues, regretting lost opportunities, they still fall back on their animal instincts. Is there an overarching battle between animal instincts and society's demands?
Oh, goodness.
David, I'm taking you more seriously than some people do.
I mean, I think that if I were to, if the characters in this book were people rather than animals, I think the violence would be over the top.
Mm-hmm.
But I usually spend every summer in the country, and I mean the country. It's little villages with lots of farmland and countryside in between and forests. And so that's my day, is nature and regarding nature. And it's a dangerous place.
Well, how did it work? Did you think of a story and then decide that you wanted to tell a story and then decide which animals you would assign to the parts?
Well, sometimes some of these were on Ira's show on This American Life. And so Ira did a show about doomed love. So I wrote a story about a squirrel and a chipmunk that run out of things to talk about after 2 weeks of dating. And he did a show called Innocence Abroad. And he wanted stories about life in another country. So I wrote a story about warblers who migrate to Guatemala and are just sort of the worst Americans that you could find living in another country.
Let me stop you for a second. It sounds like you're writing on assignment there, but in the end, these are still, you're finding ways to talk about things that you're interested in.
Well, some of them were assignments. Like Ira did a show called The Parrot and the Pot-Bellied Pig. And so I wrote a story about a parrot and a pot-bellied pig, which I never would have thought to put together. But when you can write about anything in the world, sometimes you just welcome anything that would narrow that down. And so I did. And I like an assignment. I like one. That said, there were a lot of these that just didn't work. I wound up with lots of stories about birds for some reason. So I caught a few of those just because the book was too bird heavy. It was interesting. I had written, like, I don't know, 2/3 of the book, and then Ian had it. And then I told him, I'm working on a story about an Irish setter. And he said, oh, can it be a short-haired dog? Long-haired dogs are too hard to draw, which is something never occurred to me.
So you wound up writing about a short-haired dog?
No, I kept it with long hair.
Let him make the adjustment.
But I wrote a story about groundhogs. And my editor said, I think we'll pass on this one. She said, the problem is that when you write about a cat, we expect a cat to be vain. We expect a monkey to cause trouble. But we don't have any expectations of groundhogs. So it hadn't occurred to me that that might be a problem. The story had bigger problems than that, but it's something I hadn't considered.
Well, in the past, most of the stories that you told, essay stories, whatever they were, there's been a lot of discussion about the truthiness of some of the things you've written. They were based on personal experiences. How mm-hmm. many of these things are based on personal experiences?
Oh, there are a couple.
There's one at the airport?
There was one at the airport. I was at an airport in Wausau, Wisconsin. And those small airports are the worst, security-wise. And I'd been wearing this vest. I don't know what got into me that I was wearing a vest. But
what's wrong with a vest?
Oh, it wasn't like a vest for a suit. It was more like a workman's vest or something from, 19th century England, that kind of thing. And I would wear it, and I would look down, and I would think, really? Am I really wearing this vest? I just wasn't sure about it. Anyway, I'd worn it for about 20 days, and then I was in Wausau, Wisconsin, and this woman, this grandmother at the security, said, I need you to take that vest off. And I said, well, can I ask you why? Because I've gone to 20 airports. I want the vest off now. And I just thought, I'm going to turn you into a rabbit. So I turned her into a rabbit who's put in charge of chief of security, who's made chief of security in a forest after some animals go missing. There were a few Oh, and I had a story in the New Yorker about 6 weeks ago, because I got stuck in this line in Denver for people who had had their flights canceled. And so I wrote a nonfiction account of that in the New Yorker, and then I wrote a fictional account, The Toad, the Turtle, and the Duck, and I used lines from that same story. The Toad, the Turtle, and the Duck were standing behind me in line. And I just looked, and it was just a question of deciding what animals they would be.
You, as we said, you live in England. I would think that there's a whole different menagerie in England than there is here. I've thought, for example, Tony Blair. I don't know what animal I would make him into. He was on the show recently. Unfortunately, I didn't get to interview him, but I did get to interview Shree, his wife, some years ago. And I started thinking, when I was thinking about you living in London, what animal would I have made Shree? Would you, or Tony Blair, for that matter, with that that perpetual smile, no matter how things are going?
Because they do have, badgers. They have badgers there. We're not big on, I don't know that they exist in North America. We have them in France,
badgers
and hedgehogs. But it is, they do have different wildlife there than we have here. When I heard a really funny, there's a radio program in London. they have programs on the radio that are so mean.
Mean.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
So mean. And they took a line from Cherie Blair's autobiography. And then they asked contestants to fill in the blank. And, oh, boy, it was, I'm sorry, I can't remember the punchline. Damn, it was funny.
But they, does that inspire you, hearing that kind of humor? Because it's very different from sort of humor.
They have things there, shows there that I remember seeing a pilot for a radio show years ago, and David Rakoff was one of the contestants. And to me, David Rakoff is witty. Witty is funny and smart. And I think that Sloane Crosley is witty as well. But I don't think there are many people like that. But there are quite a few of them in England.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all on these radio shows, and they just keep you laughing all the time.
I guess if you grew up in a certain tradition, you wind up being able to do that sort of thing. And wit has always been valued in the British tradition.
But I just don't know that
we had Mark Twain. They had Oscar Wilde.
But these people are so quick. I mean, David Rakoff, it's the same way. And I don't know that you can train somebody to be quick like that.
When you were living here, you traveled in a circle that included David Rakoff and Stephen Colbert and your sister Amy, some others, all have become big stars now. Did you have a sense that you were all working towards some level of success?
Well, Amy Moore knew Steve from Second City, so I just knew him in Chicago, but just mainly as a friend of Amy's. There were certain people that I met along the way that I always had a feeling about, you know, that I thought, well, it would be an unfair world if Jackie Hoffman didn't get a lot of attention, if David Rakoff, so there were people that I met along the way that I did have a feeling about.
Well, when you were doing those things, you were also doing theater pieces, and there was a lot of collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
Now most of your work is pretty much you sitting in a room, writing something, and then perhaps performing it later.
But I think a difference was when we were working on the plays, and again, it was like my sister Amy and myself, and then they were equally written by the other people in, you know, by David Rakoff, by Jackie Hoffman, by Sarah Thayer, because there was a lot of improvisation. But I think what happened is that I started going on tour because I was never in the plays. But then I started going on tour and reading out loud, and I thought, oh, well, this is a way I can get attention, you know? And it just felt really good. So I haven't really written a play since then.
But you obviously love to perform, although You think Elaine Stritch does your stories better than you do them. Maybe you can enlist her to go on This American Life and read some of your pieces instead of you.
Well, The New Yorker does a version. Maybe it's for blind people. And I think what they do is they take The New Yorker and they hand it to somebody and say, here, read this. Mm-hmm. And it's not an actor, and it's somebody who hasn't prepared, because you can sense, you can hear their sense of surprise because they don't know where this thing is going. And someone had said to me, oh, it's just, it's murder listening to that. And I love it. And it's the only way I can listen to my own stuff is read by somebody else. And Elaine Stritch is fantastic, but I like those people that read The New Yorker as well.
My guest is David Sedaris, whose latest book is Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk. It's published by Little Brown, has illustrations by Ian Faulkner. Can you bring us up to date on some of the other aspects of your life? Well, first of all, I was wondering whether you were talking about the difference between British humor and American humor. Do the British respond well to your humor?
Well, I've done a couple of series now for the BBC, and then I'm doing another one. I'm going to record another one this winter. And I don't read anything about myself, but the fellow who produced it said that it went over well and that they asked me for more. And I've just started doing readings in theaters in England. And when I started doing them, the audience was mainly American. So now it's kind of tipping. And so now it's more English people than American people.
Are you still a non-smoker?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's been almost 4 years. I don't even think about it anymore. I thought it was going to be so hard, but it wasn't really.
I went from being tolerant of other smokers. After I quit, I'd think, well, you know, I understand. I was a serious smoker. Could you blow the smoke in the other direction? What? Are you crazy? That's where I am now.
Oh, really? I still let people smoke in my house. And I had some guests, and I said, why aren't you smoking? And they said, well, because we don't want to tempt you. And I said, it's my job to stay quit. That's not your responsibility. And it really kind of irritated me that they weren't smoking in my house, because I didn't want them to say, oh, it felt good to leave there so we could have a cigarette. Damn it. It doesn't matter if I smoke or not. I said, you can smoke in my house and you can smoke in my house. So it does. When I heard the other day that in New York City, they want to outlaw smoking in some parks and stuff, I was just full of rage, but it was secondhand rage.
Well, there was a New Yorker cartoon some years ago of a guy outside a bar where everybody's smoking. He says, I'm going to go inside and get some fresh air. Me Talk Pretty one day was optioned for a film, but what happened?
I got out of it. I just wasn't thinking too clearly. And then the director was a lovely guy. It involved my family, and my family was fine with it. But then I started thinking, well, someone's going to play my dad, and someone's going to play my mom. And, oh, I don't know. I didn't want to write the screenplay. So basically, I felt like what I was doing was taking my family and turning them over to someone else and saying, you know, do what you like. So it just didn't feel right to me. So I got out of it. But now someone's optioned a story. And it's this young fellow, and he sent me a movie that he made called Easier with Practice. It was such a good little movie. And then he wanted to option a story that I wrote that didn't involve my family. And I thought, okay, all right. So, you know, who knows? Most movies never get made. But I would actually be really curious to see what this – and again, I don't want to write the screenplay. I don't want script approval. This would just be his interpretation of something that I wrote. But I just think the world of it. He's young. He's a kid.
It might be nice to have Ian Faulkner do a series of animated – films based on the pieces in Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk.
You know, I don't think that way. Like, I don't think movie-wise. So it's hard for me to think of how that could be like a little movie. But if anyone were to be the animator, I would sure want it to be him. I mean, because I don't... That's the thing. Like, most often when you have a book, when I put a book out, I think, well, most of the stories were in The New Yorker, right? And if there's something in Esquire and you don't like it, it could be a problem with the story. If there's something in The New Yorker and you don't like it, there's something wrong with you. So I always had that to comfort me.
Do they reject any of your stories?
Oh, sure, sure. But I always had that to comfort me. I would think, well, the stories were in The New Yorker, so how bad can they be? And with this, I think, well, you can go ahead and not like the stories, but I defy you not to like the pictures. you would be insane not to like the pictures.
So are you going to continue writing about animals? I'm assuming that you are working on new pieces.
Mm-hmm. I turned this book in. I don't understand why. Nowadays, it takes no time at all to make a book, but they want your book 9 months in advance. And I turned this in July. And I turned it in the morning, and then I started writing. That afternoon, I started writing material for my lecture tour.
Mm-hmm. Well, to some degree, you have an advantage over many writers in that you have all these other places to write for. You could be pretty sure that you can publish something in The New Yorker or do it on This American Life or do a lecture tour and present it there. You get immediate response from people from what you've written. I don't know. Does Hugh read them first?
Oh, goodness, no. Like, Hugh, you're really asking for trouble if you read something to Hugh. Because he'll be honest. He'll say, I stopped listening 3 pages ago.
Well, maybe he's too hard on you.
Or if he says, that's awful, that's horrible, then I know that it's funny.
This sounds like a marriage made in heaven.
But reading in front of an audience, because who knows, like, I don't know. It's really hard for me to imagine anybody. I've seen people buy my books, so I can imagine them buying them, but I can't really imagine anyone reading one of them. So that's what's nice about reading in front of an audience, is that you do get that response. And when you're writing something that you're hoping might get a laugh, then you either get that laugh or you don't. If you were writing something serious, I don't know if you'd listen to someone, the sound of someone crying or them opening their purse for a tissue. I don't know what you would listen for, but with this, you can read something out loud in front of an audience and pretty much figure if it's working or not. Hmm. That said, I was reading with Sarah Vowell once.
Do you change it then? For example, if you've read something in front of an audience, maybe you've done something on This American Life, and now you've got to put it in a book. Will you change it if you didn't get the good laugh or if the audience response was odd?
Sometimes it's not about a laugh so much as I had a story in The New Yorker a few weeks ago, and it involved a lot of information that I've gotten from pilots and flight attendants. And a pilot had told me a story, and I had that in my original draft. And I didn't recount the story for a laugh. I just thought the story was sort of disturbing on many different levels. But the problem is that it stopped the story. That people in the audience weren't sure whether they should laugh or not. And then inevitably some people would. And then these people would be looking at those people thinking, well, you're a racist for laughing at that. And all this stuff was going on in the audience. Meanwhile, I'm just moving on with the story, but they've stopped. So it made sense to cut that because, again, it wasn't a question of a laugh or not. But there was something in this book that I added a little German phrase for drinking song, right? And that stopped the audience because all of a sudden I was using a German word and I was moving on and they were still back there. So
I understand perfectly well. Sometimes there'll be a beautiful turn of phrase in an introduction that I'm writing and I'll cut it out because I know that people are going to dwell on that and then they're going to miss the next 2 minutes.
Well, I love books on tape, so and I just listened to Freedom, the Jonathan Franzen book on tape. And there were a couple passages in that book that I had to – because when I read something and it moves me, I need to write it down in my diary because I just want to see – I want my fingers to know what excellence feels like, right? So I just retype it in my diary. And that means I have to stop my iPod and play it back and kind of dictate it. And I just type with one finger and then you got to go back and it winds up taking me a while. But I wouldn't cut that out of a book because that's what keeps me. There's a difference between reading something like that, because then you have the leisure and you can stop and you can close the book and you can reflect and you can think, man, what a remarkable writer this person is. But sometimes when you're doing something out loud, you don't, Ira taught me that, you know, that you just don't want to, you can lose your listener. And I don't mean that my writing is so beautiful that my listeners are, that's never been my particular problem. But I can do things that make a joke that people don't understand, or a reference, or take a little detour that people can't find their way back from.
Well, you do write well. Yeah, don't worry about it. You write well in your way, just as Jonathan Franzen writes well in his way. And I want to thank you so much for being with us, David. David Sedaris, whose latest book, with illustrations by Ian Faulkner, is Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk. It is published by Little Brown.